Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this April 8. Renee Beyer has traveled the globe, visiting 10 countries on four continents to put human faces on the issue of global poverty. She witnessed people suffering from the ravages of war, disease, child labor, forced prostitution, starvation, rape, homelessness, abandonment, blindness, and environmental toxins. And these people had little or no hope of help. She went to Bangladesh, Bolivia, Cambodia, Ghana, India, Liberia, Moldova, Peru, Romania, and Thailand. She's the senior photojournalist at the Sacramento Bee. She won a Pulitzer Prize in 2007 for A Mother's Journey, series of photos over the course of a year about a 10-year-old boy battling cancer. And she was a finalist for the prize in 2013. Her photographs make up the bulk of really an extraordinary book with images that will stay with you forever once you see them. The book is Living on a Dollar a Day, The Lives and Faces of the World's Poor. It has just been published this week. And we will have pictures on our Facebook page. Some of Renee's pictures will be there if you want to look at the extraordinary work that she has done. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. We will be welcoming phone calls as we try to get a better understanding of the people behind these faces. And also we'll grapple with the issue of how can it be that a billion people on Earth are living on a dollar a day or less? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and you can find us there, at K Dunn Show. Renee, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Boy, have you done extraordinary work. These are pictures that will just stay with me for a long, long time. You captured so much, and I would imagine that it had to take some kind of toll on you because these aren't easy. There are pictures of joy, but these are people living in dire circumstances.
Yes, it is heartbreaking, and of course it's going to live with me forever. But, you know, it's given me the ability to give a voice to those who otherwise would not be heard, so I'm extremely grateful for the experience.
Mm-hmm. We're overwhelmed when we think of the number of people on Earth, and you must have found, because you went to slums and you went to all kinds of places on Earth, that your vision of what the Earth looks like is an Earth that really is filled with a lot of people who are very poor.
Yes, they are. You know, extreme poverty robs people of options in life, and the cycle is nearly impossible to break without help, is what I found. You know, most of the poor, you know, work very hard at jobs many of us would not even consider doing or not, you know, and they have no access to basic health care or education, which keeps them at the bottom of the economic ladder and usually for generations.
Mm-hmm.
So this book hopes to shine a light on this. And I know that, you know, this topic has been discussed over and over and over. And as a photojournalist, for me, you know, I was really working hard to put a human face on this reality. And so I'm really grateful that all these families allowed me into their lives to tell their stories. And as you say earlier, they are harrowing and very emotional. But there is also some hope, you know, in one of the two of the chapters that gives great examples of what people can do.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start with the area of education. I was really struck by the many pictures in this book that are pictures of very young children. Some of them are 5 or 6 years old who have no hope of going to school because they're doing the fishing for the family or they're rounding up the cattle or they're helping to do farming. And that's their lives. And they start when they're really young.
Yes, they do. Children are pretty expendable in some of these communities, and so they are used sort of as the workforce because their families could really not exist without their help. So it's really helps them to survive, and this is this cycle that needs to be broken. I'll say there is one really good example of how they are trying to break that cycle and give education. Now, I visited way up in northern India, the Tonglen Charitable Trust that is building this tent sort of community school so that they can take these children away from these parents and give them a little bit of education and give them one meal a day and also give them showers so that they can start to break this cycle of extreme poverty. But these children are all working because they have to work to help with their families, to live to see tomorrow. Mm-hmm. There is no real vision of education. And most of the parents, you know, when you ask them, you know, what is your hope, they are, most of them say, my hope is to try to get my child in school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In India, this is the photo and just the thought of this that will ever haunt me, and it sure must haunt you. This photograph of a 22-year-old mother who was starving her child so she could use her to beg on the streets to earn money for her other children. The child was 2 years old and weighed 9 pounds.
Yes. No, that and this is my fear. My fear is that this picture is so harrowing that people will look away instead of looking into the eyes of this child. Mm-hmm. It's almost unimaginable for us to think, you know, here in the United States that this could ever exist.
Yes.
But the poverty is so extreme that this mother in her mind can't think of anything else to do but to sacrifice one child to feed her others. And this is the extreme depravity that's happening.
How do you, this has to hit you just as a human being who's photographing this happening. I don't even know how you do that without wanting to give this family all that you had, but then there were others that you were filming who needed all that you had as well. How do you just take that in as a human being and those people who were with you?
You know, for me, I justify being able to do this by hopefully gaining some help and getting these pictures in the right forums to motivate change. So, you know, that's my underlying, coping ability, as you might say. But, of course, these pictures are always going to be in my head, and they never leave me. But I just hope that in some way, before I die, that some real help can happen in this world to help alleviate this extreme poverty that exists. You know, we all come together as a nation in a wonderful way whenever there's like a tsunami or some horrible thing happening, but people don't realize that 18,000 children a day are dying from reasons that are fixable, that are not, you know, that the causes are preventable. And I think that is the premise of what people need to take away from this book, that without help from other places, there, you know, these children are dying for no reason.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some of the dangerous work that people are doing and also that children are doing. You have pictures of people working in really toxic environments, getting certain bits of machinery that might be recycled, people who are wandering around in complete filth and living in some cases in complete filth, hoping to get some kind of scraps. I didn't realize how many people on this planet make their living, if you're poor, by recycling and what kind of life that is like. You're exposing yourself to so many health risks, aren't you?
Yes, they are. And yeah, I will say the resourcefulness of these families is remarkable of what they do to survive every day. And I've witnessed this in almost every country. But yes, for example, in Ghana, where there is children sifting through e-waste, specifically little Fatty, who's only 8 years old, who had tears streaming down her face from the effects of malaria as she tried to sift through this toxic, horrible black smoke. She can barely breathe and is trying to find a few little metals so that she can sell them to recycle so that she can eat to live till tomorrow. I mean, this is the reality that these children are facing. And none of them have any, you know, protective gear. I mean, all the way up to Bangladesh where this little boy is, at, you know, cutting wood and the axe is coming down within like an inch of his foot. To little children that are, you know, working to do a lot of the farming. The little boys who were running in the bush in Africa that were only like 5, 6, 7, 8 years old who all suffer from malaria. A lot of the children do, in fact, and are used as really the work for their families. And those little boys that were running had were in such fear of being snake bitten. Their father had been snake bitten and was blind, and their brother had already died from being bitten by a snake. And they were running. I was running with them in the bare. You know, they were barefooted as they ran through this jungle and had no water, no food to drink. They were picking fruit off of a tree to eat, and it's hard to even imagine these situations. But I am here to testify that they exist, mm-hmm. and this book testifies it as well.
Oh, yeah, it does, and then some. And you don't think about, when we think about work here or medical care, even though we debated in this country, that you point out young, and you have pictures of young people who have malaria, as you said. They're enduring head-splitting pain from malaria, and there's no hope of getting better because there's no medicine available and there's no treatment. So you go to work in excruciating pain.
Yes, they do. And this is because they don't have really a choice either. I mean, this is survival at its bare, necessity. It's not about really being forced to work. It's working because you don't have a choice, because you can't get to tomorrow unless you have food and you have nourishment and you have something to eat. And the other problem is, of course, the fact that the food that they are eating isn't really a nourishing food. So think about when you've had a bad day and you may not have eaten the best food that you can possibly eat, and you're kind of feeling a little groggy or not up to the best that you can be. Well, this is how these children are all working. They're working with very little and not much nourishment at all. So you can see that also is another level of illness that they're having to deal with.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about subsistence living is what makes they're working for, a subsistence kind of living, did that vary greatly from country to country that you went to, or could you come up with a pretty standard definition of what subsistence living meant to the poor?
Well, I think it happens in a lot of countries. All the ones that we visited, they are on subsistence living, and that is basically they are trying to every day get up and just get to tomorrow. And they're doing it in all different kinds of ways, like fishing. I mean, even those children that are fishing in Cambodia on those tiny little boats, and you can see in the picture, in the background is the capital of Phnom Penh. And these families, all they own are those tiny little boats. That's it. That's all they've learned for generations and generations, and they just can't seem to get out of that level of poverty. The children are needed to do the fishing and to go with them on the boats every day, so they're not able to go to school. And so that's a good example of just how they subside.
Where was the picture you took, which also struck me, Renee, and there were several of these, but homeless young people who had been taking different kinds of drugs to get them through the day and also to ease whatever kind of illnesses they may be. I can't remember what drugs they were taking, but there are pictures of vacant youth, guys usually, who are just evidently sleeping on the streets. Was it in Thailand, or where was that?
It was in Bangkok, Thailand, and those were children that were all banding together. They were sniffing glue. Yeah, they were just orphaned children, or children that had run away from abusive homes, that just weren't getting any of the medical needs that they needed. And to survive from the pain and abuse, they were sniffing glue and just wandering the streets. And they get exploited, et cetera. And it's a terrible cycle that's Thailand.
Which brings us to orphans, and there are a number of pictures of orphans. You wanted particularly to talk about this orphanage that's in Peru, an orphanage for 860 children, and it's run by a man who, by all accounts, appears to be saintly.
This is Miguel, and he is a great example that shows an extraordinary achievement that one person can do. I visited this orphanage that housed more than 830 abandoned children who were all smiling and learning and loved this founder, who actually kissed and hugged every child and knew every child's name. It was incredible. He just started out because he had lost his own child, and then he had invited a few other children to live with him as a result of just not knowing what to do, and wound up with this this orphanage that helps children in so many ways. It helps train them and has and teaches them music and sports and education, and I think it's the largest orphanage in the world, and it's really remarkable.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest. She's prize-winning, Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist Renee Beyer, and she traveled all over the country documenting the human faces of the world's poor. She visited 10 countries on 4 continents. The book has just been released this week, and it is an important book. We frequently talk about inequality on this program. Well, here it is in human form with some extremely important and pictures that will stay in your mind for a long time. The book is Living on a Dollar a Day, The Lives and Faces of the World's Poor. Renee Beyer is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. If you'd like to see a couple of her photos, please go to our Facebook page. There are, I think, at least 4 of her pictures from the book on our page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls for Renee Beyer, and let us start with Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello, Kathleen, and hello to Ms. Beyer. I want to thank you both for bringing this subject to our attention again. It's not that we're unaware. When the Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh was asked what our purpose is here on Earth, he said, "We are here to awaken from the illusion of our separateness." And I think if people looking at these photographs were to think not of, oh, those poor people over there, but think of humanity as a body that we're all the cells of, we'd begin to say, boy, there are a lot of unhealthy cells in this body. This body is not in good shape. And when we live in a world in which the top 85 earners in the world have the same wealth as the bottom half of the world's population, we're in trouble. And the response back sometimes is, well, if those 85 families were to give up their wealth and redistribute it, that would only be $500 per person for the bottom half of the world population. But if you're living on a dollar a day, think about what $500 would mean in terms of education, medicine, food, opportunity to thrive in a world that you just happen to be born into a very destitute and difficult part of. So I hope people listening to the program and who get the opportunity to look through the book will see themselves somewhere reflected in those images, and we'll take some form of action and just feel sorrow, but we'll actually be moved to make the world a better place.
Mm. Thank you, Carl. Very well stated. Renee?
And also, I'd like to echo this quote from the Dalai Lama, who wrote the foreword to the book. Unfairness in the human condition can only be remedied when people everywhere care.
And there is something, we talk about this inequality quite a bit on this program, because it does strike me as immoral. There's something so fundamentally wrong with the structure of everything to have 85 families have as much money as half the world's population. I don't know what you do with that, but you got to say, wait a second, something is terribly, terribly off.
Wouldn't it be great if we could get the 8 billion or 10 billionaires, I guess, that exist and be able to sit them down at the table, hand them each the book and say, come on, let's get together and fix this.
Well, at least get one of them at the table. Can you do that?
I don't know. But, you know, it would be a great thing, I think, too. But, you know, the bottom line is that everybody can help in some way. And I think that all of us, you know, can give in some respect. When you think about living and subsisting on just $1 a day, that you could actually, for $10, I mean, a child wouldn't have to work for 2 weeks. I mean, I know that that's very simplistic, but it is the reality that these children are only making $1 or $2 a day, or these women, mothers, you know, to live. And it is a very unequal, you know, you're right on that. But, you know, how do we solve this problem is the big question. How to solve it? I'm trying to put it in front of everyone, and I'm hoping that by looking and viewing this book, which has great resources, by the way, there
yes.
are some amazing philanthropic and nonprofits that are doing great work out there. But it just needs a little more. It just needs another push. It needs something to help it really to solve this enormous problem.
And your work is so important. I'm sure you must know this on some level, but I liked Carl's comments that it's not as though we're unaware of this situation, but that we tend to think of these people as separate from us, that we're not all part of the same humanity. And you make us see that humanity in this book. It's large, it's heavy, it's filled with pictures that are unforgettable. There it is.
Thank you so much. And my biggest challenge on this project was to be able to make that relationship and that connection with the people who would be looking at this book, because I know that a lot of people don't get to do the international travel that I get to do, and they don't get to witness this from the very intimate way that I'm privileged to do that. And so, you know, I wanted to try to engage the reader so that they could, you know, actually imagine themselves in these situations, and could they exist in these situations? And if they ask themselves that question, could I exist in this situation? And I think the answer would be no, probably I could not. Then for them to ask themselves, well, what can I do? Can I do something that could help alleviate this, but not be overwhelmed and think that it's just a billionaire that can help? Because it's more than that. Everybody can help on some level.
Thank you so much, Carl, for your call. David in Missouri is next. Hello, David.
Hello, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Can you?
Yes, I can.
I'm just working. I listened to that. That's the first time I've ever called. I have a home and shelter in the Philippines on Cebu Island for about 50 children. I take care of them. Basically, I'm the sole provider for them. Financially, I send 90% of my paycheck to the head mother to take care of the children. The gentleman that has 850 children, I commend him for what he's doing for the children. All the children, I call them my children. They're orphans, street children. Two of the oldest ones are going to college, you know. And, you know, I don't get any help from anybody. It's just me. I ask people from time to time for help, or they say they'd like to help, and when I tell them how they can help, they decide to change their mind. Well, I can't do it this right now. I mean, I don't even have a home. I don't have a car. But I take care of them children. They get food even if I go hungry.
How did you go about doing all of this, and why, David?
Why? Well, I'm a Vietnam vet. Mm-hmm. I've seen many children that were hungry in Vietnam, and when I took my R&R in Philippines, and you know the wages over there are $3 a day if you have a job, and I don't know, I sometimes say call it my penance or whatever you want to call it, but it makes my day go better that I, you know, I get to talk with the children and, listen to them play with two little puppy dogs and stuff like this. But I got like about 40 to 50 children.
Mm-hmm.
And, it astounds me, the American people, we have so much. We waste so much. But they can, you know, they can't help a child. You know, I mean, two of the children that the head mother takes care of, we found in a dumpster.
Oh.
And we put them in the hospital and brought them, you know, basically brought them back to life, so to speak. Mm. I mean, they would have been dead if not for us.
Yeah. Well, feel free, and we'd like to hear more from you, David. If you want to send us a little more information, we'd like to hear it, and we could certainly, because you called, I know there are a lot of organizations, but you called, we can put something on our Facebook page as well. So how should he do that, KP? Send it to... Oh, I'm just going to put you on hold. KP will talk to you. Okay. Thank you, David, very much for the call. Well, that's quite a story, Renee. I'm sure there are others, but my goodness.
Yes, David is, wow. That's incredible, amazing work that he's doing. And there are, this is not to say there isn't a lot of really, really good-hearted, amazing people out there doing work. It's just that we all need to have a shared humanity and do our share.
Yeah. There are a lot of, some of the pictures, of course, are, many of them are disturbing, and there are some pictures of laughing. We'll get to those. But these stories of being sold into prostitution by your family, forced to have sex day in and day out as your eyes turn yellow and your liver collapses from hepatitis. Oh, these are hard to witness, aren't they?
Very hard to witness, and very emotional to take photographs of these women who are, you know, already being exploited in a horrible way. And, you know, the hope is that people will see this reality and that this injustice can stop. It's just, you know, a human rights issue as well as anything else. And, you know, that one woman who I photographed, well, I'd say she's really more a girl afraid to tell her age. I mean, her eyes were literally yellow with hepatitis. And this is just, egregious, one of the more egregious things that I witnessed. But it's, you know, and it's not to say that we don't have prostitution here in the United States, because we do. I mean, on all levels. I've covered domestic violence and prostitution. But to have these families selling their children into this because of poverty, frankly, that's the root of a lot of the problems in these countries, is that they just don't have any other way of surviving.
Mm-hmm. We haven't even talked about, we talked about you being a photojournalist and a Pulitzer Prize winner. You went to all of these countries because of the Forgotten International, the nonprofit. Do you want to talk a little bit about what that group is, Renee?
The Forgotten International is a nonprofit in San Francisco that has worked with programs in the U.S. and worldwide to alleviate poverty and the suffering that it brings, especially focused on women and children. So that's their foundation, and it's run by the founder, which is Tom Nazario, who is a teacher at the University of San Francisco, a professor, who teaches law, and he's more of an expert in human rights with women and children. And so it was his vision to have this book to go with this foundation that he founded.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Eugene and Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good afternoon, Kathleen, and to your guest. I'm wondering, with the large income disparity that we have in this country, if the author has looked at any of the homeless here in this country that are living on a dollar a day. And basically, I'm thinking of the homeless. But I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Eugene.
Oh, yes. Tom Nazario has done a lot of work with exactly that, the homeless. The foundation is called the Forgotten International, but that includes the United States.
Thanks for the call. John in Chicago, hi.
Yeah, hello. How are you guys?
All right, John. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. A little nervous, but...
don't be nervous.
This subject really hits close to home for me. My wife and I, we just got back from a two-year road trip driving our vehicle from Alaska to Argentina.
Ooh.
And we volunteered at orphanages all along the way.
Mm.
And it was, you know, one of the main reasons we did it was to see the world with our own eyes and, mm-hmm. and for ourselves, and to be able to try to help. Because like so many people have said, here in America, I don't think we really understand what suffering is. Maybe suffering is not necessarily the right word, but a different way of living life. The thing I realized working with so many poor people and children and communities is that they don't realize, most of them don't even realize that they're actually poor. Or they realize they're poor, but they actually don't realize how much they're suffering, or what we would consider suffering. For instance, the rape and the incest and the physical abuse. It's such a part of their culture and the way they've been raised that it's all they know, and they don't know anything better. And so you can try to help them and teach them, and you can kind of throw money at the problem, which is what a lot of Westerners do when we go to these places. We think that's the best recourse, or somehow the money is what they need. But it goes much deeper, in my opinion. It's more of a cultural thing. It's like they, for so long in their genes or whatever, they've been used to one way of life, and now this Western capitalistic culture has been thrust upon them, and they're more they're used to working in the fields and surviving as a communal kind of base.
Mm-hmm.
Society.
Renee.
Well, most of the people that we visited with were really searching for hope and help, and I don't think that they were looking at us from that capitalistic viewpoint. But I do understand what you're saying, and of course there are a lot of different cultures in all of these countries that we visited, and we did a lot of research as to, work within their confines and respect their cultures, which, of course, you need to do. It is a very deep, deep, sordid problem. And, psychologists and social workers are working to try to, get to some of these families in an incredibly, thoughtful way, because they do have a much deeper understanding as to how to interact with these families that are, in this cycle that's very hard to break.
I wonder if you ran into this very much. There was a photo of an 80-year-old woman in Bolivia, and she worked a farm growing wheat and beans. She wasn't very happy to see Americans because she thinks they're part of the problem when it comes to climate change, because her wheat for 20 years isn't growing very well. There's not enough rain. There's too much heat. Her beans, she says, are almost worthless because countries like ours are putting too much carbon in the air. Did you find that there was some anti-Western feeling for that very reason, or also that people were mad about the great disparity in wealth?
I'm not sure that she actually understood the great disparity in wealth, but she did have a good, interesting viewpoint on the fact that, the resources on her farm were, being impacted in that way. But that is a problem. I agree that, sometimes we are seen as this sort of bigger, almighty country that, is seen from that sort of capitalistic way. But on another fold, we give so much help, and we do so much for everyone in the world that it's mostly them seeking us out for help than it is them really condemning us for anything that we've done, from what I was able to see from the countries that I visited.
Thank you, John, for your call. George in Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Yes, good morning or afternoon. I wonder if your guest is familiar with a book that came out 20 years ago now called Material World. And the book actually a little dated, but it's a wonderful book. It basically is 16 authors who travel to 30 different nations with a family considered typical of the culture. And they took pictures of the people's entire possessions, and then they put them out in front of the place where they lived. And so you see great contrast from all over the world, from Ethiopia, where it's just like, you know, people just have a couple of bags of food and maybe some pans, to what the American typical home might be like. Wondering if your author is familiar with the book, and if she knows if there's been any attempt to update it.
I have not seen that, George, but that sounds like a terrific book. Have you seen it, Renee?
Yes, I actually have seen that book, and it is a terrific book that is by, I believe, a person, Peter Menzel, in San Francisco, who worked on that book.
Mm.
It's probably got the same size as this book, and what's interesting that he should mention this book is that the same designer worked on this book.
Oh, really?
Yes, David Griffin, who is a former director of photography from National Geographic.
Oh. So,
that book is a great book that shows them the differences in all the different cultures.
Yeah. George, have you seen Living on a Dollar a Day yet?
Have not, but I'm looking forward to it very much.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll appreciate it. Thank you.
And I should say that this Material World book, and she's right, it is by Peter Menzel, is available in a lot of libraries. So it's a great book for children to look at, just so they can see some of the differences around the world.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's a very, very good book, like I said. And this book is just getting into bookstores this week. So hopefully it will have the same impact as that book has had over the last 20 years.
Mm. Thank you, George, for your call. We'll take more in a moment. We're talking this hour about the poor among us living on a dollar a day, the lives and faces of the world's poor, with extraordinary photographs by Pulitzer Prize winner Renee Beyer, who is our guest this hour, and traveled to many countries around the world to look at the face of poverty and to look at the issues that are a big part of poverty, disease and lack of education and lack of hope, kind of a cycle of poverty that repeats, repeats, repeats. And welcoming phone calls. Our phone number, a couple lines are open right now, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and several of Renee's pictures are on that Facebook page if you'd like to just get a glimpse of what she's been doing. And we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Lori in Minnesota is our next caller. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I wanted to make the point, I guess it goes back to the gentleman who quoted Thich Nhat Hanh and comments that we hear out of the Dalai Lama and all of that ilk, that we really need to, I guess it would come down to each of us addressing individually our consciousness and what we put out there in the world, along with actions that we take, so that we reach a tipping point in our human consciousness where we have no tolerance for finding ways to exploit people in positions like this. Otherwise, all of the help that we can give them in the world won't help unless we don't have that that portion of humanity that is always looking to exploit people. There's intolerance for it.
Mm-hmm. Renee? Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, there you are. Okay.
I'm still here.
Okay.
Sorry. I was just trying to digest what she was saying.
Right.
You know, Everyone has to digest the information, you know, that's put in front of them, and they all do it in a different way. And we all, you know, find ways to give back in society. And I think that basically, you know, there's no better gift than actually giving. And so it's sort of a, I don't know, people can live their whole lives and they never really feel like they have a purpose. But I'm just saying that if you really think about it, and you think about the last time maybe you gave something to somebody and the feeling and the amazing feeling that you get from within yourself that you've helped someone else is really the biggest gift that you can ever even feel for yourself. And that I would ask people to try and think about that when they look through this book.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. How many people, I know you found a lot in this category and the book isn't big enough to give a fair sampling of all you met, but I'm interested in people who, shelter is a big thing, and people who squat, people who just are looking for some place to stay out of the, in some circumstances, cold. It's cold in some of these countries, and to stay out of the rain, they just live where they can in little shelters that they may find in various places. But that's precarious, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's not just cold, but also heat, too.
Right,
in
right.
India, I will tell you that when I was working in one of the slums in India, it was so hot that my shoes actually melted.
Ooh.
That's how hot it was. And I was working in this slum, and the smell, I mean, there's so many things that we take for granted, I hate to say this, in our country, about just the smell of fresh grass and the fact that a lot of these people who are squatting in these, even if they can find a shelter to squat in, which some of them do and some of them don't even have that, some of them are sleeping on just a prayer mat or a mat in front of a mosque just because they feel safe there and they have nothing else. But we have such a privilege of being able to smell fresh grass and a flower. And these are things that you think about when you're in these other places that, you know, we all get to come home. And they really need us to help them so that they can get even these very simplistic joys of life.
Steele is next in Appleton. Renee, hi, Steele.
Yes, good day, everybody. Yes, I was on a binge watching foreign films from the Appleton and Nina Library. And I saw one on Afghan children going through minefields. And so I tried to Google to find it, but I saw this one. And I've never seen it. And the title of this documentary, The Land of Enlightenment. And it's a group of Afghan children living around Bagram Airfield. They dig out personal mines in order to sell the explosives to child workers working in a mine, in a lapis lazuli mine, and those stones go to Kazakhstan and China. And in the movie I saw, the young kid that was running everything, he said that the best mine diffusers were the ones that had lost the limbs. They're the smoothest. Anyway, just another comment on. And one other movie I saw, it's called Lucky Express, about all the young children that live in the train stations in India and how people are trying to teach them and give them education there. Anyway, my comment.
Thank you, Steele. Thanks very much for your call. We have a couple lines open if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. You have used these words to describe the people you photographed, and they're striking words: grace, generosity, fortitude, and bravery, and people who really did allow you into their lives. Isn't that extraordinary that instead of, you know, hatred and bitterness and all of that, you guys have you witnessed grace, generosity, and fortitude and bravery.
And absolutely, and you know, and I learned one extraordinary truth in all of my travels, and that is that the human spirit transcends even the worst deprivation. And if we hope to change it, we must connect at that most human level. These families are, they are on the brink of survival, and still they find a way to Actually, here's a good example. I photographed this little blind girl, and she was begging on the streets of India to support her brother and her mother, who could not. Her mother could not work, and I spent several days. I actually stopped the crew so that we could follow her story, because in most countries, you know, people will just walk past these beggars as if they don't exist. So. In the telling of her story, though, which was very moving, of the fact that she gets up in the morning and she begs, and then in the afternoon so that they can eat, and they're sleeping again in India on this mat. By the third day, this child and her brother were smiling and clapping and singing me a song.
Mm.
I mean, you know, my heart melted. I mean, how could not? And this is what I'm talking about this extraordinary human spirit that still transcends. And you'll see children, there's a chapter on children at play, where children have never seen a toy, but somehow they figure out a way to, you know, make a little ball so that they can play catch or grab a vine out of the trees and play jump rope or, you know, still be children. And it's just a reminder that these are children, that these aren't alien, foreign photographs, that these are children just like we all have. And that we all need to help them, just like we would our own.
Mm. Jerry in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, Kathleen, your guest. I have a question. By the way, Kathleen.
Yes, Jerry.
I think that you do incredible work. I mean, you're just fantastic.
Thank you, Jerry.
All the issues you bring, and I just applaud you for that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
However, regarding your guest, you know, I travel quite a bit myself. I was wondering what your feeling is regarding the faith community, particularly for the more advanced nations, in terms of addressing what you're talking about today.
Renee.
I'm sorry.
The faith community, how are they addressing all that we've talked about today?
The faith community?
Yes.
Oh, I think they're doing a great job. I see churches that have all of these great sponsorships of different communities that have volunteers that go over and help build homes and do all kinds of terrific things. I think that the faith community does a world of good in a lot of different places all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jerry, so much for your call. Nancy and Sheldon, hi.
Hi. I would just like to encourage people to follow the direction that my husband and I have. We have sponsored a child, more than one child, throughout different countries through Children's, used to be Christian Children's Fund, and now it's just Children's Fund. And it's not that much that you send every month, and plus you can give them a birthday gift and a Christmas gift, and they're educated over there. There's food that's bought, and, you know, there's just so many, many children around. We adopted two orphans from an orphanage in our lifetime and added to the children that we've already had, and, you know, we're not poor because of it. We've been sincerely blessed with everything that we have. And now we've got a little girl. She's in Mexico, and we get a letter from her. We write to her, and she tells us how her education, and that is so, so important, education.
Mm-hmm.
And these agencies, they provide that for the children so that they do have something as they get older.
Thank you, Nancy, so much. And we should add, we're talking about the photos because they make this book, but as you said earlier, Renee, there are all kinds of suggestions of ways people can become involved. The book is filled with that as well.
Yes, I know. That's really important. We don't want to overlook that.
Thank you so much for what was a grueling trip for you, I'm sure, but your work is just extraordinary. And I hope that a lot of people see this book. Thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to be on your show.
Renee Beyer, she's a photojournalist, a Pulitzer Prize winner, and she is the person who really makes this book what it is because the photos are extraordinary. Living on a Dollar a Day, The Lives and Faces of the World's Poor, just came out yesterday, so it'll be entering bookstores and libraries during the course of the week and beyond. Thanks to Marika Suval for producing this show. Thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production in our studios here in Milwaukee. Tomorrow, a recent report shows college spending on athletics is increasing at a faster rate than that of academics. We'll speak with the executive director of the Knight Commission on Intercollegiate Athletics to find out why tomorrow at 2 o'clock. And at 1 o'clock, we'll look at the Supreme Court. We'll talk with a correspondent for the New York Times, the McCutcheon decision of last week. Thanks for all of your calls, everybody, and for listening. Great conversations ahead. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 1 until 3 on the Ideas Network.